Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namasami. So we're just over the halfway mark of this 2010 rains retreat. So don't worry about that because it goes very, very slowly. The second half is always longer than the first half. So you've got lots and lots and lots of time to be able to do what needs to be done, especially because you've been building up momentum. And hopefully it's momentum of peace and quiet. And you find that in meditation, in the practice towards enlightenment, our job as practitioners is to put in place the causes. As long as the causes are in place, the results come. And it's as if you keep on putting in the causes and it just builds up that momentum, the momentum of practice, the momentum of restraint, the momentum of just spending a lot of time in solitude. That momentum of solitude, that momentum of restraint, that momentum of just stillness builds and builds and builds until you finally, one occasion, two occasions, during your days, during your weeks, you finally get into deep meditation. Now remember, when those things actually happen, it's nothing to do with you. You just put the causes in place and the meditation happens. People who don't understand this, they think, now I can do it. And they expect every other meditation afterwards to be the good one. And they get frustrated. Remember, all frustration is not because there's something wrong with you, it's because of delusion, because of stupidity. Now you're realizing that you think you're in control of this and that you can just push this button, press that button, and get into this deep meditation. It doesn't work like that. You have to learn the causes. And that's why that I've taught again and again and again, not willpower, but wisdom power is the way to develop deep meditation. It's the way to become enlightened. Try forcing, and you'll find you usually just end up being angry and frustrated. And I've often noticed that connection between people with strong willpower, and they get angry. And people who are soft, who let things go very easily, they've got more loving kindness. They don't get angry so often. It's obvious to me that willpower is controlling. That you always come across a brick wall, the thing which you can't control, the thing which you can't change. When you come across that brick wall, the things you can't change, things you can't sort of alter, you usually get frustrated and get angry. That's just the cause and effect nature. So you see where it all comes from. But in particular, to be able to develop the nice meditations and to get the insights which are based on those deep meditations, and to actually see, what we're supposed to be seeing here, the Dhamma. Just needed quite a few of those deep meditations. You don't need to get heaps and heaps of meditations. It's just like the Dhamma is on the other side of a wall. But the wall is a bit too high for you, so you can't see over it. So you can actually believe what other people say, what's on the other side of the wall. But, you haven't seen it for yourself. And meditation is like jumping high, high, high. And you don't have to jump high all the time. You just need to jump that high once just to get your head above the wall for that one time in the whole range retreat to see what's on the other side of the wall. And of course, then you know what's on the other side of the wall. You've got the experience. You've got the insights of seeing what it's like when you let go, or rather what it's like when you disappear. So our job is just to keep putting those causes and conditions into place as much as we possibly can. And after a while, it has to happen. It's just the cause and effect, and it's nothing to do with you. So it's nothing to do with whether you're a born meditator or you're a hopeless case, whether when they handed out the meditation genes, at the back of the queue and you didn't get any. It's nothing to do with that at all. It's just cause and effect. You just put in the time, do a lot of meditation, a lot of walking, a lot of sitting. Don't just sit meditation. Do the walking meditation as well, because otherwise your body gets very stiff and it gets very achy and also gets quite sickly, which is why that we, in every of the monks' huts, we built this walking meditation path. In the Anagarika's huts, we've got the four walking meditations paths there. There's plenty of other places where people who haven't got that facility can find a nice quiet place to walk backwards and forwards, in sort of comfort and in quietness. So develop the walking meditation as well. It's very, very helpful. And certainly, In my practice, especially as a young monk, we used to do a lot of walking meditation as well as sitting meditation, sometimes because I wasn't used to sitting long. And it took a while before your joints and your bones could be used to sitting long periods of time. So it's nice to be able to do that walking meditation too. And you got some great states of peace in that walking meditation, great states of stillness, which I've talked about many times before. And again, you don't force it. You don't try and do slow walking meditation or fast walking meditation. You just do it as it comes naturally, because the whole job is not to force it, but to have this beautiful sense of letting go, standing back, and just being an observer, and a passive observer who watches these things without making them happen. And that basically means, again, being in the present moment and shutting up. Because you find out that every time you're off into the future, you're just wanting something to happen, or you're trying to escape from things. Every time you're in the past, it's a special escape. You know, just thinking you can fix up the world by fixing up the past. But of course, it's gone, it's happened, it's finished, and it's a complete waste of time. So instead, we just focus in this moment and be quiet. And you always look at that thinking process, and what is it? I sometimes look at the thinking process as just the political speak, because it's all like how I govern my mind, how I govern my body, how I govern my life. That's thought. It's like the language of government. And you know what sort of the reputation of politicians is in countries like Australia and other places. They just, you know, what they actually say is just spin. And I look at the thoughts which go on in my mind, it's just exactly the same. It's spin, it's bent, you know, by what you want to see or by avoiding what you don't like to see. And so that thought, I don't trust it very much these days. You make use of it, but basically I just don't trust it. It's not truthful. Just like you don't trust politicians. So, you know, you don't trust, you don't put all of your faith in this thinking process. So you just let go. Remember what I'm saying over here is that use wisdom power. You try and stop the thought, say, stop thinking. That's another thought. Maybe another third thought, the fourth thought. Every time you start and do something, you're thinking again. And you just get yourself caught in a knot. But when you relax, you get this beautiful sense of being an observer, standing back and just watching all of this. That degree of aspect of mindfulness, of just standing back and watching. And as you stand back and watch, you become like the bouncer at the nightclub. So it means that, you know, you see things as they're happening. And things which are going to to cause you problems, you know they're going to cause difficulties, you say no to them, you stop them. These are the troublemakers who come into your nightclub, and it's your job to keep them out. So that's what the mind does. It doesn't really do very much. It just says no, to stop. It's the effort to avoid, to stop, to, you know, to make sure that people don't go in and cause trouble, to make sure that those states of mind, such as lust or greed or anger or ill will and all this other stuff, or fear, which can come up into your mind and create a lot of havoc, that degree of mindfulness which just stands back, observes and watches, can actually say no to things. It doesn't need to beat up sort of these interlopers, just they say, no, you're not allowed in. And they usually go away. That's the great thing with wisdom. It is that powerful that as soon as Mara says, you know, the doorkeeper knows me, he doesn't put up a fight, he just walks away. So that's our real job, to set up that mindfulness, to set up that gatekeeper, to actually also to have that wisdom, to know, you know, what are the sorts of things which are going to cause you trouble. What are the sorts of things, you know, which are going to be conducive to, you know, to your peace and to your happiness? And that's where a little bit of wisdom comes up. You know, you've been there, you've done that many times before. You know the types of thoughts, mind, the moods and other sort of inclinations of the mind causes you trouble. You know, you've been there, you've done that, you know it very often. You know it very well, sorry, because you've experienced it many times. So, you know, when you're meditating, have your blacklist. You know, the people who are prohibited into your mind, you know, during your meditation. I don't mean like real human beings. I mean those thoughts, you know, thoughts of lust, old girlfriend, sex, money, you know, people have hurt you, plans for the future, what you're going to do next, where you're going to go, all that sort of stuff, which can so easily get into your mind and just take you away from your meditation. You've been there, you've done it, you've got lost many times before. Set up that blacklist, even to the point that you write it down on a piece of paper. you know, the sorts of people which aren't allowed into your mind during a meditation. Write it physically down on a piece of paper and put that piece of paper right in front of where you sit and meditate. So just the last thing you see before you close your eyes, you know, are the things which are banned, you know, from your mind during meditation. You put that up there and it means you are actually teaching your gatekeeper. The gatekeeper will actually remember that, and it starts to see like lust or like fear or no planning coming up in the mind. You will see that and notice it, and the bouncer, because his bouncer's been well informed, clearly knows what's allowed in, what's not allowed out in, will actually say no, those things won't come into your mind. And it's a beautiful training of the mind. It's not done, again, done by force, it's done mostly by wisdom, by creating those conditions. You know, the brainwashing yourself, conditioning yourself, so that you know exactly what's allowed in and what's not allowed in. And you do that, it saves you so much trouble. And it means that you have more, often, deep, powerful, peaceful meditations, which means you have more happiness, more power to your mindfulness, which means it's even more easier to keep, you know, the more sneaky troublemakers out. You know, the people who sort of come well-dressed but their bikies underneath or whatever else they are. You know, the sneaky troublemakers, you can get to notice them as well, so you can keep them out because your mindfulness is very, very strong. And that's just because you've got the happiness, the power, and that means you can keep more troublemakers out, which means you don't have any trouble in your meditation. It goes very peaceful, very deep. And again, it becomes so powerful that maybe you may be able to get your head above that wall and see what's on the other side, see the Dharma, see freedom, see what the nature of the mind, the nature of freedom, the nature of happiness truly is. So that's just our job. And once, of course, you've seen that, wow, you're really starting to flow along powerfully in your meditation. Because once you see the Dharma, once you see that, you know, the body is a mess and you can't really rely upon it, you know, even if you're young and even you've got a healthy body, still it's, you know, an irritation. You know, you notice that all the things out there in the world which you work so hard for, you know you're not going to be able to control them, they're all going to fall apart. And if every monastery which you build starting falling apart, standards always drop. And it's always a case, always will be. You reach your peak and then it's all downhill. It deteriorates. That's the nature of things. So understanding all of that, you can let all this stuff go. You've got that wisdom to know the nature of things which you build in the world. All sankharas tend to decay. Understanding that, you don't sort of buy into these things anymore. You don't give them so much importance. You don't think that that's the greatest thing in the world, just to get the perfect translation of the Anguttara Nikaya. Once and for all, to do it so it doesn't need to be done again. As soon as it's done, it's already out of date and somebody else gets another better translation. As soon as you build a kuti, it's already falling apart. As soon as you, I don't know what else you do, you buy something here, a computer program, it's already out of date, you need a new one. It's always something going on. And so after a while, you don't invest so much of your time in such things. Instead, you invest it in what, you know, really, as a monk, as a practitioner, we should invest it in just stillness. And so what actually happens, instead of the mind keeping going out there into the world, doing this and doing that, we've seen over the walls, that's a complete waste of time. So instead we stay at home. And that idea of like staying at home instead of going out, this is where I wanted to introduce the main subject of this evening's talk, like the asavas. You know, this, we can actually look at sort of the problems in meditation in life, the problem of samsara being caused by craving. But sometimes that's hard to get your head around, you know, deeply. We sort of understand what craving is, but we still keep on doing it. We all know that craving is going to cause suffering, but we can't stop ourselves. We all know we eat too much, but, you know, it's just too nice down there on those tables. So, you know, what's actually going on there? Is there another way? And again, instead of like using our willpower, which just again usually is counterproductive, I've tried that, it usually doesn't work. Instead of using our willpower, we use our wisdom power. And one of the great ways of using wisdom power is actually getting better perceptions, more accurate perceptions, more useful perceptions. In other words, getting perceptions, another way of looking at it, which actually uncovers what's going on, so it makes it much easier to work with. And this idea of asavas is a very beautiful way of regarding this force of craving. Because of the asavas, you can actually, the meaning as I understand it, is like the outflowings of the mind. It is the mind, there it is at home, you know, deep inside. You can see this when you get very still in meditation. You're right there, deep inside your mind, you know, right in the middle of the body, if you like. You're in your heart, in your cave, wherever you are, and you're deep inside, you're at home. This is just an allegory. And then when you come out, you sort of tend to go out. And that force of the mind which goes outwards, out anywhere than being where it really is right now, that's what I understand as the asavas. And I found that a very useful description because it shows just what this actually craving really is. It's just this outflowing of the mind. And it can outflow into past and future where its real home is in the present moment. You can see that, you know, thinking about how many days are left for this retreat, how many days are already gone, how many more minutes for this talk before I can go back to my hut, how many... Now, what happened earlier on today, you can see the mind just goes out, but never actually stays home. And even when you're meditating, you're there, busy, no, not so busy, quietly in this present moment, just being here. And then the expectation comes out. What's going to happen next? You know, you've left home. The mind has gone out. And when you actually look at it that way, you can see this mind, you know, it should be really staying still in this center, in this moment, in this point called now. And then the ekagata, the one center of the mind, the one beautiful summit of the mind, but it always wants to leave and go somewhere else. And you actually see that movement of the mind called the asavas. It goes out there, you know, into past and future. It goes out there into thinking. It goes out there into seeing what other monks are doing and sort of blaming them or praising them. You know, just that's one of the great teachings of the Buddha, that as monks we should not be looking at other people, we should just be looking at ourselves. That's what Ajahn Chah said, 95% of the time just look at yourself, 5% maximum to know what other people are up to. And I think Ajahn Bhamari found something in the suttas which was very similar to that recently. We just, you know, just should be looking inside ourselves more than going out into the other people, going out there into the world. So we just keep our attention inside. We don't go outwards. Even when we sort of come up for the meal and all these people are coming there, we just keep our eyes restrained. We don't go looking around. We keep ourselves inside. We keep ourselves restrained. You know, and when we sort of leave, we don't allow sort of our mind to go wandering into talking about this. Because you can see it's the mind has left home and it's gone wandering all over the place. That's called the asavas at work. They've taken you away. And certainly that you can see that in one sits down, crosses one's legs and meditates. It's just so hard to stay home. So easy, you know, just to go off here and go off there, present, past, future, thinking, planning, fantasies, and just all sorts of stuff. Why is it so hard to stay home? It's because this asava, this force which takes you out from this moment, has been a habit for such a long time. We have sought for meaning, we've sought for happiness, we've sought for fulfillment. Out, anywhere than where we already are. And it's become such a habit in which we don't really know what our home is. We've been out of our home for such a long time, for so many lifetimes, we forgot where we live. And then we come to this sort of meditation and we're asked to come home. We're not quite sure where that is. But he stopped going out. Stop going out. Stop going out. And after a while, we just go deeper into this moment, deeper into this silence, deeper into this mind, deeper into the center. And obviously, that's where your home is. And that's the whole path of restraint, not going outwards, but always going inwards. And you can see when you understand what those asavas are, you understand why the Buddha said we have to go against that stream of craving. We have to sort of go in the opposite directions to the asavas. Instead of going out there, we just flow against that current. We go inwards. And it's a hard thing to do because the deeper you go inwards, the stronger that current is to take you away. That's sometimes what it feels like. You know, you start getting deep, you start getting, say, beautiful breath or even nimittas. And you're going so deep, but it's just so hard, as if you're repelled outwards and you start doing things. I've seen that with many meditators. They get to nimittas, they've been doing all the right things up to that time, and then they start to mess around and control. They go out. So our job is to get this idea, this perception inside, of not going outwards, but going inwards. Not even going out to the next moment. Because I notice that sometimes you're sitting there, you're getting peaceful, you're getting some deep states coming up, and that expectation of going forward into the next moment. What do I need to do to get to the next stage? That's an asawa. That's a moving out from this moment to somewhere else. So because I got that perception for such a long time, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going out. I'm going inwards. So going into this moment, into this experience, into whatever I'm doing right now, I really just go into it. And that becomes a very, very helpful perception, because going inwards actually stops the craving. It stops all this movement of the mind away from where you are. And I even just practice that when I start meditating. And I often told you that when I start meditating, you're starting from the same place as anywhere else. We all start from the same sort of starting line. I feel sort of the aches, the tiredness, just the heat, the cold, just the pains, the sluggishness of the body. But then sort of I don't follow that. I just stay with it and go into that sluggishness, into that difficult feeling, into that unpleasantness, rather than just trying to find an escape from it. Escaping from it, in most places, people escape by going out, away from it. I realize the true escape, the true freedom from it, is going into it. So my sort of, it's not an asawa anymore, I'm not going out, I just go in the opposite direction, going inwards. Of course, at first it goes against the grain. Instead of, sort of trying to do something about the irritation or the ache, you just go into it. And actually you find it actually vanishes. You go to a peaceful place. After a while you realize it's because these asawas, they keep on causing all the suffering. They're just going out here, going out there. It's actually not just that you are missing the home, but just actually being away from that home is suffering. Just having these asawas pushing you and pulling you all over the place. That very movement, that very agitation of the asawas is suffering. Whether you get what you want or you don't get what you want, just the movement is a pain. And so after a while you get the hang of just going inwards, where there's more peace, there's more stillness. And again, you get that perception, that sanya, so strong that when you do come across these places where you get excited or you get afraid, where you start to expect things, instead of actually getting an asawa up and just moving away from that, you just move right into it. And you always get the sense of diving into things rather than just bouncing out of them. And the asawa, because it takes you deeper into things, and I like the idea of deeper into things because there is a great sense of stillness. You're not going anywhere. You're not sort of trying to create anything. You're just using what you already have and just going deeper into it. That's why I say that you can start with even unpleasant states of body and mind. I often tell people that just one of the crucial experiences of my monastic life was that time I had typhus fever. And just with a body which was really sort of way behind the starting line of most of you, just really tired, exhausted, really sort of no energy, giving details of what it was like just to go to the toilet. And I will never forget this. There's no bedpans in this hospital, no nurses. You just had to help yourself. And just the toilet was at the end of the ward. The lucky monks, the ones who had much better karma, had their bed next to the toilet. I was 5 or 6 beds away. And it was like a great expedition. Just even to stand up, first of all, took all your energy, because you were holding on with shaky legs because you're just so weak. And then just to view those old metal rail beds, to view the sort of metal frame of the bed next to you. Am I ready for it? And then lurch for it and grab onto it before you fell over. And I'm not exaggerating, that's how it was like, and just moving just from one bed to the next until you got to the toilet, and it took a long time. And just that's how weak you were, and just with that sort of tired body and just aching from fever for many weeks, and you just decide to get into a deep meditation, and you could do it. It just shocked me, just how you can go inwards no matter where you start from, and you can get into the deepest of meditations even with typhus fever. And that was a great experience for me, just to show, yeah, it doesn't matter where you start from, it's just how you make use of that. It's not willpower at all. I couldn't have any willpower, I was just too tired, too exhausted. But I just had enough wisdom to know just how to go into the center of things. Go into the center of that ache, the center of tiredness, not trying to get rid of it, not trying to avoid it, not trying to escape from it, but going into it, against the stream. So the mind, instead of going outwards with the asavas, went inwards and got into a beautiful state of meditation. And I know that can be done. And so I'm not afraid of those sort of sicknesses, and you can just do, start from anywhere. But the problem is, again, we forget that, and we think that, oh, we just do another more thing, just have another thought, another fantasy, just do this and do that and get that out of the way, then I'll meditate. You're just going in the wrong direction. So our job is having that mindfulness, telling that gatekeeper, yes, to stop all this stuff which takes us away. And instead just stay put, to stand your ground, to be still. And once you are still, you're not moving, you just, nature is go inwards. And that's actually what happens, and that's the opposite of the asavas. And the deeper you go inwards, you come to, you know, these places which start rejecting you, just pushing you out, strong asavas. But once you get over that barrier, usually when you get into nimitta stage, you know, the asavas haven't got any power anymore. They don't push you away. You just go deep inside, and deeper and deeper and deeper inside as you fall deep into the center of things. You find that really is your home, you know, in the deep sort of states of meditative bliss. If you've got any home, that's one of the best. And so what you're realizing then is when you go into the center of these things, all of the joy, the peace, the fulfillment, the happiness which these asavas promised you by looking over here, looking over there, going north, south, east and west, up and down, you had already. You just went in the wrong direction. You should go inwards rather than outwards. So that wisdom power just tells you what you should do in your meditation. What you should do when you're walking. Just always go inwards into things. Don't go outwards. Into the center of time. Into the center of silence. Into the center of the body with the breath. Into the center of the breath where you find the delightful breath. Into the delightful breath where you find nimittas. Into the nimittas where you find the jhanas. Into those jhanas where you find cessation. That's why in one of those suttas, and it's actually, I think, the Panchalananda Devaputta Sutta. That was where the Buddha said that, the Panchalananda Devaputta said the Buddha who discovered jhanas. And that was explained in the Anguttara Nikaya. Somebody asked Ananda, what did the Buddha mean by that? And, you know, he's called these jhanas, these like escapes, these like breaches in the wall, these escape tunnels out of samsara. And he's saying the escape from the five senses is the first jhana, the escape from this last movement of the mind is the second jhana, the escape from this pity is the third jhana. You're always going deeper in to these escapes, but you don't escape by going outwards, you escape by going inwards. So that when you understand this, whenever you're in your hut and you're sort of getting restless or you're getting bored or getting frustrated, you just go in deeper rather than going outwards. You go into the frustration. You go just into the boredom. You just go into everything. And when you find you're going inwards, you'll find there you'll find the peace and the stillness. There you will find the fulfillment and the relief. You go deeper into things. And you go deeper and deeper and deeper into things. And of course, as you know, those old similes, 1,000-petal lotus You go deeper into things until you find the emptiness rather than the heart of all things. There's nothing there. And this is actually where you've jumped above the wall. You know, you found what Ajahn Chah kept on saying every time, Wang, nothing there. Or like that story, which, you know, the personal experience with Ajahn Chah, we were just joking this morning about, you know, now this monastery was expelled from Wat Pa Pong tradition, we decided to start a new tradition, the real Wat Pa Pong tradition. That's only a joke, don't think I'm going to do that. Or the new Wat Pa Pong tradition, just like the new Kadampa tradition. I get into trouble for that. Maybe take that off the tape when you edit it. I don't do stuff like that. But instead of actually trying to change things, go deeper into things. And if you start doing things like that, you find that, you know, that there you'll find the peace, there you'll find the fulfillment. No matter what you experience, you can always go deep into the center of it. And there you find your real home. And again, I was going to say about that personal teaching Ajahn Chah gave to me when he asked me, Ajahn Brahm, or not Ajahn then, Brahma Wangsa, why? Why? And when I said, I don't know, he just laughed. And then afterwards he said, the answer is, there's nothing. There's nothing. My, me, or I, in Thai. There's nothing. Very clear. Very precise, just a beautiful emptiness which you find when you go into the center of things. If you stop going into the center, you can come to sort of these illusions of a jit derm or an essential consciousness or a God particle or whatever, but you keep going inwards and inwards until you find in the center there's nothing left there at all. Just like in science, you just go into sort of matter and you find molecules, you go into molecules, you find atoms, you go into atoms, you find the nucleus with protons and neutrons, you go into the center of the proton, you find quarks, you go into the center of quarks, there's nothing left anymore. You go beyond the Planck length, I think 10 to the minus 36 meters, and there's nothing left. That's why they call that like the froth. The froth of the essential matter of the universe. Go deep inside and just nothing. Beautiful. That's just a bit of physics as I remember it from years and years and years ago. But just going into the center of things is actually just the way which we find peace, the way we find wisdom. And that's actually what the asavas mean to me. So resist those asavas. Say no to them when you see them coming. Always which drives you onto something else. Say no to them. And then you'll find you go in the opposite direction. Now, so no matter whatever you're experiencing in this monastery, whatever's happening, especially, you know, in the time you're spending alone in your heart on your walking path, in that time, try and go into the moment. Try and go into the experience. Never try and go onwards. Always go inwards. Then you find you'll stop. Onwards creates more time, creates more problems. Inwards is the end of time, is the end of craving. I often say it's craving which creates time. When there's no craving, when there's no asavas, you're going inwards, time ceases to have any meaning for you. You become still, you become absolutely peaceful. You get great joy and happiness. You just keep going inwards and go inwards till the end, till there's nothing left. And that's how the asavas, when they're resisted, when you go in the opposite direction, using wisdom power rather than willpower. You perceive those asavas. That's the perceptual framework which you look at your meditation, you look at the way you're doing things, you perceive it that way. You can see what's happening and you decide to go the opposite direction. The bouncer says, these are the asavas, these are the troublemakers in chief. You're not allowed in. The only ones which are allowed in, the things which go inwards. And then you find your meditation just goes off deep into the deep meditations, the jhanas, until there's nothing left. You're going in the opposite direction. So try that as a perceptual framework to help your meditation. The opposite of the asavas, going inwards. It's a short talk this evening.
Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhanga Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Saṅgho Saṅgha